Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken?, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode, a conversation with Dean Susan Fournier, where she answers the question at the heart of the show.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. There is no one thing that makes a mass shooter. However, our guests today say that at least three recent mass shooters, including the suspect in the Highland Park, Illinois shooting, share a common trait. They were deeply immersed in an online subculture marked by extreme gore, ultra-nihilism, with content that's designed to break down a person's sense of reality. It's part of an emerging new profile of extremism in this country, one that's little understood by law enforcement, lawmakers, and parents. So we want to try to understand it a little better today. Alex Newhouse is Deputy Director of the Center on Terrorism, Extremism, and Counterterrorism at the Middlebury Institute of International Studies, and he joins us today from Golden, Colorado. Alex, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Meghna. Thanks so much for having me.
And Emmy Connolly is with us as well. She's a researcher of far-right extremism, digital propaganda, and online communities, and she joins us from Washington. Emmy, welcome to you.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Well, first of all, Alex, let me just start with you. When you reference the fact that three recent mass shootings share this common trait of a very particular online subculture, which of the mass shootings are you thinking about?
So the three that I'm thinking about primarily are the shootings in Oxford, Michigan, the Uvalde, Texas shooting, and then the recent one in Highland Park. And I should say that these shootings share common indicators. There are aesthetics that each of the shooters seem to be engaging with that are part of this trend that we are going to be talking about today.
Okay. So, Emmy, and also, by the way, both of you, just feel free to jump in on questions that I ask. I'll be occasionally directing them to either of you, but really, just add as much as possible as the both of you can. Don't wait for me to continue to direct it back and forth, okay? So, Emmy, let's dive into these online subcultures, and let's use the Highland Park suspect as an example, because I believe of the three mass shootings that Alex just laid out, it's the suspect in the Highland Park shooting that left sort of the most detailed digital trail. Is that right?
Yeah, he did. He left behind a complicated and very public digital footprint that made it much easier for both researchers and, unfortunately, the general public to kind of track his activities online. And he was pretty explicitly immersed in spaces that celebrated acts of mass violence, gore content, and generally celebrated violence.
So what do you mean by these online communities? Where do they exist?
It's on anywhere from, you know, kind of some of your mainstream social media platforms where they're careful not to violate terms of service, right? They're able to keep content within community guidelines. But then there's also places like, you know, any of the image boards, any of the deeper web forums, where those rules go out the window, especially if any of the communities are a little bit less public. Where you often find a lot of these people is on places like Discord or Telegram, where they are less likely to be moderated unless there is an internal report.
Okay.
And I think one of the, if I can jump in real quick here too, I think one of the trends that we see across extremism and radicalization in general is you have basically like increasing intensities of these types of communities as you go further and further into more encrypted, more narrow, more niche communities. So for instance, some of these trends start on 4chan or Akun, the image boards, and then they get seeded out and get picked up by more private, smaller scale, more narrowly focused communities as well. And then the intensity of that and the possibility of violence coming out of it increases as that sort of narrowing occurs.
Okay. So we'll talk about the potential impact of the kinds of digital environments created by these communities. But I do think in order to help people understand as much as possible, I'd like to talk in a little more detail about what the Highland Park suspect left behind online. I mean, do you have, Alex or Emmy, do you have a couple of examples of specific examples of what he did online that indicate to you that he was a part of some of these online subcultures? Alex, I'll just start with you.
Yeah, I think we can talk about a handful of examples, although I should mention up front here that as researchers, Emmy and I attempt to try to stay away from actually sharing specific platforms and types of content as much as we can, because it can inadvertently promote these types of communities. But what we can talk about is that the Highland Park shooter seemed to be immersed in one, forums dedicated to gore and graphic violence, and then two, in communities that are organized around these sort of community-driven puzzles and like problem-solving types of content. These types of content are variously called like alternate reality games. There are some that are based on what are called creepypasta communities, which are basically like viral horror stories that get picked up and turned into collaborative fiction. So it's this combination of, like, on the one hand, he was talking about and interacting with extreme graphic violence, and then on the other hand, he was also doing things like trying to produce his own alternate reality games, engaging with other people who are doing this sort of collaborative fiction type of thing. All of that together, those two things are some of the core indicators we look for this particular type of violence.
Emmy, go ahead.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think Alex is right. It is the combination of those two things is particularly troubling, because it shows a person who is both comfortable looking at, engaging with, celebrating violence, and a person who is familiar with the process of crafting narratives. And that's really troubling. You put those two things together, you have a really potent recipe for communicative violence, for public violence, mimetic violence. This is a person who's, you know, deeply part of the internet and understands how every previous violent actor before him was then turned into a meme or celebrated online or had their, you know, their digital history analyzed. And so each one of these shooters that comes forward does it with the knowledge of how it worked out for all of their predecessors. And if a person is deeply involved in these communities, that means they understand that more than most, which is why it is such a risk factor.
Mm. You know, I have to say that I completely understand your position as researchers, having a reluctance to speak, you know, publicly about, in detail about some of these online communities, the forums, their names, etc. I understand that. At the same time, I mean, there's been some solid reporting that provides some of those specifics, and I'm looking at reporting right here from NPR, so I'm just going to quote them because I think it's important for, again, on behalf of listeners, for folks to understand in detail what we're talking about, because sometimes my concern is that if we aren't specific enough, when we just say online communities, et cetera, it can sound a little benign, but it's not, it's anything but benign, right? So I'm looking at a story here from NPR that said that the Highland Park suspect was very active on a particular online forum where the whole point of the forum was to share extremely graphic videos and videos that show the aftermath of violence, and that the Highland Park shooter shared a photo of a politician who had killed himself during a live press conference. That's one specific example. And also, lots of people have pointed to the suspect's music that he had posted before it was taken down regularly on Spotify and YouTube. Emmy, can you just talk for a second? The music seems a little surprising. Is that a big factor here?
Being a musician, no. But some of the music was dark. It was troubling. That is not inherently a problem. He had one music video about a school shooting. And I think Ben Collins from NBC kind of put it best, where he said, like, yeah, that's extremely a red flag, but not one that can be moderated, right? School shootings are a thing that regularly happen in society. We can't stop people from making art about it. But his, you know, his feelings towards it, right, the way he presented it is a warning sign, right? It wasn't a negative representation of a mass shooting. I think that those things would have been more than enough grounds for intervention, although not necessarily content moderation or, you know, legal trouble.
Right. You know, in that video that you're referencing, that's the one where there's a sort of a hand-drawn animation of a school shooter. Is that the one?
Mm-hmm. Correct.
Yeah. So what's interesting about that one is that I believe in the music, there's a refrain that's repeated over and over again, where he talks about, quote, living the dream, nothing's real. I just want to scream, you know, blank this world. Alex, can you talk to this is getting us then into the nihilistic part of these online communities, that nothing's real line. Does that stand out to you?
Yeah, that absolutely stands out to me, and is it establishes this mass shooter and his content in a line of other attacks and other types of communities that are getting increasingly nihilistic. So what I should mention, just to step back for a moment, a lot of the internet communities that we're talking about today, from the mainstream ones like, let's say, far right corners of YouTube and Instagram and Telegram, to the 4chan image board types, and then into these deeper, more narrow, smaller forums like the Gore forum that this shooter was an active member of, all of these communities have been organizing around a number of different currents over the last, let's say, 5 to 10 years. They have been based on pretty extensive and virulent anti-Semitism and racism, and then they've also becoming more and more nihilistic as a result of this. And so as we get over into the attackers and individuals like the Highland Park shooter, what we're seeing is this is all building towards this break with reality, this point where they feel like they can do nothing except undertake an attack against the world itself.
Well, we're talking today with two researchers on extremism about the little known online communities that some recent mass shooters in the United States were active participants in. We'll have a lot more when we come back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/onpoint. That's Indeed.com/onpoint. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken?, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. These days, it's hard to ignore the debate over the role business should play in society.
There's crescendo around profit, period. Is profit bad? Is capitalism evil? These themes are out there.
Is this criticism of business warranted? And if so, how do we fix it? Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode of the Is Business Broken podcast.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and today we're talking with Alex Newhouse, Deputy Director of the Center on Terrorism, Extremism, and Counterterrorism at the Middlebury Institute of International Studies, and with Emmy Conley as well. She's a researcher of far-right extremism, digital propaganda, and online communities. And we're talking about the little-known online communities that celebrate gore, violence, and ultra-nihilism that several mass shooters were recently participators in or deeply immersed in these online communities, and whether it forms a new profile of extremism in the United States. Now, Alex, can I just pick up with a thought that we ended the previous segment on? This nihilism aspect. What do you exactly mean? Well, what is the content saying or doing that's sort of churning this sense in users' minds that nothing matters, nothing's real?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's in a large part an outgrowth of more, shall we say, mundane or at least familiar reactionary communities that feel like, you know, society is breaking down, that there has been a sort of, you know, backpedaling from the heights of society, and that all progress is really actually, you know, regress. And this is pretty common across far-right politics and activism in general. We see this a lot in far-right terrorism more broadly. The even more politically oriented and justified mass shooters like the Buffalo shooter and the Christchurch, New Zealand shooter talk to the same idea that, like, the world is breaking down, something has to be done. But that's sort of like the one step below what we're talking about today. The next step up or deeper into this is this idea that not only is everything broken, not only do we need to tear it all down, but actually that time is basically breaking down and has become basically irrelevant. And there are a lot of different factors to this. And you know, we're in the nascent stages of really understanding what's going on here. But in a lot of cases, what you'll see is that these attempts to create narratives, to create fiction around, you know, an attempt, like an effort to justify why the world is breaking down, results in people starting to lose track on what's real and what's fake, what's fiction and what's reality. And out of this comes this sort of upsurge of just pure, like, you know, nihilism, this desire for sowing chaos, for becoming, in some cases, the legend of your own narrative, while at the same time taking revenge on a world that, you know, a lot of these people feel has wronged them very deeply.
Yeah, to elaborate on that, go ahead, Emmy. I think one of the really important things about our understanding of violent extremism is that getting somebody to believe in something ideologically, with the doctrine, with the manifesto, it is a lot of work. It's an investment. You have to get somebody to read something. You have to get somebody to buy into it. You have to get them to believe in it, and you have to get them to act on it. And that's a lot of work for a person who's going to end up killed or arrested after they do an act of terror. That's a person you only get to use one time. This is a fast track where you don't have to buy in fully to any one worldview or even have like an image of the future, right? You don't have to have a real plan. You have to separate yourself from reality enough to feel strongly that your actions don't have consequences here, that they don't matter, that they aren't real, and you do them to test the limitations of both yourself and, you know, the reality you have created for yourself or the one that you've torn down.
So help me understand a little bit more about how that happens, that sort of breakdown of reality through this content. I mean, I suppose I'm putting myself in a parent's position and wondering, well, if I'm looking over my kid's shoulder at what they're looking at on their phone or their laptop, like what kind of content would I see that's doing this stuff?
Well, you'd see a lot of distorted images, a lot of grainy memes. There's a visual element to it that is almost extremely difficult to describe over an audio medium, but it's intentionally, you know, very disturbing, very uncomfortable, and, you know, confusing to look at. It's highly, highly distorted images often. And a lot of times it is accompanied with, you know, either mild to severe horror content. And then in the deeper stages, it's gore. It is images of mass shooters. It is deeply disturbing, like sometimes pictures of animal abuse or other images from acts of terror. I don't know how easy of a thing it would be to notice looking over somebody's shoulder if it wasn't, especially if it's in the early stages and it isn't something you're familiar with. In the later stages, you look at a gross image and you know it's a gross image.
Alex, is this content deliberately designed to to do this? Because I think you've also mentioned in the past to our producer that there's even things like videos with flashing lights, etc., that are created to be watched while on drugs. Do I have that right?
Yeah, you've got that correct. There's a good number or a good amount of this content and a good amount of these communities that are intentionally cultivated to create these types of mental states. I can't say that they all are. My understanding from observing these communities is that some of them do sort of develop organically as a result of community dynamics and shared interests. But there is an element of this sort of influencer class who are content creators who have influence in these communities. And they are intentionally cultivating this type of content to make it so that people are meant to sit there for hours on end, watching it, consuming it. And often they will talk about these types of content as content that is meant to be consumed while in an altered mental state. Because what often, you know, they will talk about is that they believe that they can facilitate some sort of brain chemistry or brain state transformation as a result of this. So they will discuss using drugs in conjunction with watching this content. They will discuss the ways that they feel like their brain is changing over time. And some of the other things we know too is like over time, people start talking more about these themes, these fictions, these lores as increasingly real to them, increasingly salient to their own lives, to the extent that, like, you know, in certain communities, they might literally feel like they're in a relationship with one of the Columbine shooters, or they feel like they have immersed themselves in some sort of fantastical fiction and truly believe that they're a character in it. And a lot of this is facilitated by the types of content and the types of community that they're engaging with. So, you know, as you mentioned, Magna, the types of content do have a ton of flashing lights. They are seemingly incoherent. They have a lot of just static, just noise. There are types of strategies that they use where they like slip in certain really, really quick messages, almost like a subliminal messaging strategy, or really fast frames of gore and graphic violence. So like it's very incoherent, very intentionally incomprehensible, but is all meant to try to reach that sort of altered mental state.
One of the things that is really important about those images being so altered and so distorted is that they evade automatic moderation filters. So an image like from the Christchurch shooting, for example, a video that is banned on most platforms and easily automatically detected, if run through enough filters, if made grainy enough, if made distorted enough, it becomes more difficult for that content to be kicked off of mainstream platforms like YouTube or Instagram.
Oh, that's interesting. Was the Highland Park suspect an influencer? Would you consider him to have been an influencer in these communities? Because, you know, the examples that I cited before, some of them had, you know, millions of listens or views, Emmy.
I think he was trying to be in some ways, but best I can tell, he was pushing his content more to the mainstream while being inspired more by the fringe. It appeared to me that he was trying to bridge that gap through his own brand name and creating the kind of content that you have to engage in. His content was interactive. His social media profile was interactive. He left people, you know, clues and information that he wanted them to follow up on. I don't think his goal necessarily was to be an influencer of the deep, dark forums, but I think he was bringing the deep, dark forums with him into sort of the emo rap space.
Mm-hmm. So, you know, just we've already mentioned, what, half a dozen at least different platforms. And I assume this kind of content is in many other spaces as well. So areas put together form this particular online subculture or subcultures. But Alex, let me just turn to you quickly here. I mean, are they truly organic? Where did they come from? How did these some of these subcultures originate?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's in a lot of cases it's a matter of degrees. So my current understanding, based on my research, is that there are aspects of these communities that have arisen organically over time, And we can trace a lot of the origins of these communities back to, 10, 15 years to, Tumblr boards, for instance, organized around worshiping the Columbine shooter, or 4chan threads that are talking about deep, deep nihilism and a sort of overwhelming desire for nuclear war to happen. Like, these are all things that were happening, during the early days of the Obama administration, if not before. So the roots of these things do go back, and from the best that we can understand, have developed fairly organically. But the thing I should mention is that there are elements of this that have been cultivated. In a big portion of my job is actually doing research on what we call militant accelerationists, who are essentially far-right terrorists like the Buffalo shooter or like the Christchurch, New Zealand shooter, who have some sort of coherent doctrine, some sort of coherent ideology, but still have that form of nihilism. So they're sort of like one step under the types of shooters like Highland Park. And what we've seen is that some militant accelerationists are actually engaging with the types of communities and content from which the Highland Park shooter came, for the purpose of trying to exploit them or just by virtue of their own interest in these types of communities. But there is this sort of interplay going on where there are extremists who are trying to exploit it, who are trying to develop it in a certain way. So it really does depend, but there is this sort of this foundational aspect of these communities that has arisen by virtue of how the internet has also developed over time.
I'd love to hear your thoughts. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, so I also want to add that there is a purely mechanical aspect at work here. For any type of content that is subject to moderation, whether it's hate speech, gore, encouragement of violence or self-harm, those types of things get kicked off of mainstream platforms. So there's only a couple places that they can all go. And so they all end up in the same kind of digital ecosystems. They all end up either, deep in the chans or on different message boards or in Telegram channels, because those are places that don't get hit with the same kind of moderation. So with that, these, kind of disparate communities end up interacting organically and then can be manipulated by other actors who have, more concrete goals. But one of the things that makes these communities work is that a lot of the people who end up in them are already vulnerable because they were following one of the other pathways, like encouragement of self-harm. Those kind of things are really, really common.
Sort of how the people who are participating in these online subcultures may end up getting, further radicalized for a particular set of politics or beliefs. I want you to hold that thought because I do want to come back to that a little bit later. But in terms of still, again, like learning and understanding the initial details of these communities, there's a term that I've seen pop up just over the past couple of days. Now, I don't really like it. No one really likes it, but it's what it's called within the communities. Schizo wave or schizo posting? Emmy, can you talk about that?
Yeah. So schizo posting is a style of meme. It's often done as a joke. That doesn't make it less serious, but that's how it's presented within the communities. And the jokes often revolve around being detached from reality in some way, whether it is hallucinations. Often paranoid delusions tend to be the themes of the post. And that's everything from jokes about, being stalked by the FBI to, having visions. It's often full of gore or full of disturbing imagery. And it's been popular for the past couple of years or so. It seems to kind of really get its jumping point from 4chan. Originally, it was a derogatory term. It was part of a 4chan meme meant to make fun of people that they thought were delusional. And then it became a thing that they embraced on purpose. It was now a kind of similar to Hillary Clinton and the deplorables incident, where you refer to somebody as something and then they adopt it on purpose to wear it as a badge of honor. And that's kind of what happened with the concept of schizo posting. It has nothing to do with like people who actually have schizophrenia. It has nothing to do with mental health. It is a crude meme style about rejecting the concept of reality itself, rejecting the concept of a shared reality, and rejecting the need to operate within a shared reality.
I understand. Okay, so Alex, as we head towards the break here, help me understand how, at least in the three cases that we started the hour talking about, perpetrating a mass shooting became the ultimate goal out of the, it almost sounds like a self-induced psychosis that that a person can experience in these communities. How does doing a mass shooting become part of the picture?
It can be a number of different ways that it comes about being sort of the last thing that someone alights on at the end of this pathway. Emmy already mentioned one of those, which is that it's seen as this sort of like testing the boundaries of where reality has broken down, and to really put yourself through the paces if you believe yourself part of this, like detached from this shared reality and part of this fiction. You know, mass shooting, like committing a mass shooting is almost meaningless in that sort of context. But it can also be this sort of this zenith of this buildup within this fiction that you're building for yourself. A lot of these people believe that they are on the verge of becoming legends in this broken down reality space. And as a result, committing an attack like this can be seen by these people as the ultimate act of like revolting against society, committing some sort of revolutionary act, but also all of that in this context of this person rejects the shared reality, they reject any sort of shared cultural context, shared community, and this is their revenge on that.
Well, Alex Newhouse and Emmy Connolly join us today. They're researchers in digital extremism, and they're talking about a potential new profile of extremists in this country. More when we come back. This is On Point.
Did you kill Marlene Johnson?
I think you're one of the first people to have actually asked.
From WBUR and ZSP Media, this is Beyond All Repair, a new podcast about an unsolved murder that will leave you questioning everything.
Somebody should be in jail for murdering my sister.
A woman who's never been believed.
As long as they think I have done this, then they're not looking for who actually did this.
And that's what makes it a cold case.
No, it's a botched case.
And a search for the truth, once and for all.
Wow, it just gets more interesting.
Beyond All Repair. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
Be careful. You're digging in a place that's been very peaceful for a while.
Do it anyway. Dig.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and today we're talking about a little-known online subculture or subcultures, where at least three recent mass shooters spent significant amounts of time. And we're trying to understand what role these subcultures played in creating a world in the minds of these mass shooters where perpetrating such violence in reality became acceptable. And I'm joined today by Alex Newhouse. He's deputy director of the Center on Terrorism, Extremism, and Counterterrorism at the Middlebury Institute of International Studies. Emmy Connolly is also with us. She's a researcher of far-right extremism and digital propaganda. Now, I just want to pause our analysis of these communities themselves for a moment, Alex and Emmy, and ask something that's coming up with a lot of listeners. And that is, you're describing a world that's not only sort of apolitical, but since it's aggressively trying to tear down realities, Like politics is nowhere near the analysis that we've been talking about thus far. And yet we've got people commenting saying, well, no one's mentioning that the shooter was a Trump supporter, as if we didn't notice. You know, in the first days after the Highland Park shooting, there were pictures of the suspect at a Trump rally. There seems to be some indication that there was a lot of instability in his home, but it also that, you know, even his parents were pretty vocal about their political points of view. For example, after just 3 days after the Uvalde massacre, the Highland Park suspect's father liked a tweet that read, "Protect the Second Amendment as if your life depends on it." So I guess what I'm asking, and Emmy, I'll start with you, and Alex, I want to hear from you as well, but does politics play no role here at all?
No, it doesn't play no role. These part of the reason that these places are able to exist is that they are extremely tolerant of and encourage different types of hate speech, of radical politics. They are more politically agnostic as long as the politics are radical. They tend to not reject them. Because of the nature of the of violent far-right organizing, especially in the United States, that tends to be the version of politics that survives the longest in any of these communities. But the point of these communities ultimately is to supersede politics, right? Political goals have an image for a world that they'd like to exist, for better or for worse. There's a goal they hope to accomplish with their actions. That is not the case for stuff like this, for these types of communities. The only person who will ever know why he did what he did will be the shooter, for sure. But the politics of these communities are much more complex than a Trump flag or anything that could even be considered adjacent to electoral are the types of things that they reject outright.
Alex, do you want to add to that?
Yeah, absolutely. So I wanted to make the point, too, that politics... So what we've been talking about today is the direct line between the shooter's immersion in types of communities and his decision to carry out a mass shooting. Like, the way that we believe currently, with the evidence that we have, the mass shooter justified the shooting in the moment. It's based on a lot of different patterns. It's based on a lot of different historical context that we have. And from the best that we can consider, the best that we understand with the evidence that we have available, there is not a direct line between some sort of idea for, as Emmy said, a vision-free world after, and the attack itself. This is separate. This is very distinct from a shooting like the Christchurch shooting or even the Buffalo shooting, where there was a very clear line between a vision for a world in the future and why the attack was being carried out. This is not to say, though, that politics and ideology play no role. The way that you can think about it is that all of these types of attackers are immersed in ecosystems that have politics flying around all over the place every single day. They are immersed in radical politics, in hate speech, in virulent racism, in virulent anti-Semitism, in sexism, in misogyny, all of these different things. And oftentimes this does result in these types of attackers in the past engaging with politics in certain ways. So that all of that is a really very important sort of like foundation building for why an attacker like this is produced in the first place, but it is not the direct justification line as far as we can tell. So for instance, okay, with the appearance at the Trump rallies and the waving of the Trump flag, what we can tell from, you know, putting together the context of where this person was interacting on the internet and how he interacted with Trump rallies in real life, what it actually appears like is he was engaging with politics, in this case, like, you know, the Trump campaign, in the way that like 4chan and more deeply immersed, you know, online users engage with politics, which is not for some sort of political victory, but for actually, in a lot of cases, a desire to undermine politics as a feasible solution to the world's problems.
You know, as I was reading what research there is, including from you and Emmy, in preparing for this show, I couldn't stop thinking about the fact that, to me, it seems like maybe we have seen this before. Because I went back and I looked at research in the, you know, the early 2000s and around 2010s about the process of how young disenchanted Muslims in Europe became radicalized, so much so that they were willing to become suicide bombers. And for example, I pulled up a 2013 paper by Mohammed Ilyas. It was published in the Journal of Terrorism Research from the Center for the Study of Terrorism and Political Violence at St. Andrews, which I'm sure you both know very well, in Scotland. And back in 2013, he sort of categorized what he called a process of creating, in his words, uncontrollability. This sense that there was no agency, no ability to have any control over the tragedies of the world, that nothing mattered no matter what you did. And oftentimes that sense of uncontrollability was created through being immersed, whether purposefully or, you know, purposefully by recruiters or accidentally just by existing on the internet, through the kinds of videos that you're even somewhat describing now, Alex and Emmy. And Ilyas says that it's the breaking down of a sense of control, this uncontrollability, that's opened up the possibility of the acquisition of extreme ideas and the path to violence. So are there some connections here? Have we, in a sense, seen this before, Emmy?
I think the idea that violent images are radicalizing is a thing that has been known to any extremist group, network, idea forever. Violent images are traumatic and they inspire responses. And over time, viewing them, it causes you to change both your feelings towards violence and changes your willingness to act with violence. I think that's been a known propaganda tactic forever. One of the things that's really important to this type of violence is that it is agnostic to who causes the violence and why. It'll show everything from ISIS beheading videos to Christchurch footage with little interest in why the violence took place, only that they get to view it. And then the people who, you know, look at this kind of content, who are immersed in this kind of content, then go on to create their own in the form of mass shootings. The hate speech aspect is really important because it contributes the ability of these communities to dehumanize others and devalue human life in a way that makes people more willing to do violence. These are all things that contribute to a person's ability to harm another person without, you know, having that kind of instinct that would stop you. I think aspects of that radicalization process have been used for more clear ideological violence for decades, right? But there's a very important aspect of how these online communities function that I think is different now than it was in 2013.
Yeah, point well taken. So, Alex, I should have asked both of you, who is participating in these online subcultures now, the ones that we've been talking about? I mean, how are they mostly young men? How old are they?
I think by virtue of it being, you know, very niche internet communities in general, I think we can safely say that it's usually adolescents. One of the interesting facets about this, though, is that there is a fairly significant proportion of women, of young women, who end up involved in types of communities that are, if not exactly the same, then adjacent to these. So, you know, I mentioned earlier that we have been observing the development of, say, like, Columbine worshiping communities on the internet for about 15 to 20 years now. Those communities do often have a significant portion of women alongside men who are interacting with these as well. And in the past, there have been attempted attacks linked to women who are immersed in Columbine worshiping communities. So for the most part, the types of people who are going to be spun out of these communities and actually commit mass shootings are young adolescent men, But it's still, I think, an open question about the what is the extent of that? What are the proportions? And I think there's a reason to believe that it may be a little bit more diverse than people would otherwise expect.
Mm. You're describing a world where adolescent young men are able to spend hours and hours and hours and hours immersing themselves in this kind of content, and then perhaps even inducing within themselves a complete breakdown of the acceptance of reality. And then, of course, we live in a nation where that same person can fairly easily, or very easily, get a gun that is capable of killing dozens of people in mere seconds. That is the reality of this country. Emmy, do you think that law enforcement, the FBI, even lawmakers are aware enough of the existence of these communities and where they lie on the internet?
I think the fact that the internet is full of violent, hate-filled spaces that, you know, just are constantly pushing out mass shooters is not a novelty. The details of individual communities that have become more prominent in recent years is important to us as researchers, or if anybody is hoping to intervene, but largely irrelevant, I think, to policymakers and law enforcement, unless they are attempting to specifically monitor individual communities. The problem we have now is that currently our only option for intervention in the United States is law enforcement. And law enforcement can only engage if there is an actionable threat of violence against, you know, the individual or others. If a person is, you know, laying out a bunch of red flags, but, you know, you can't prove beyond a shadow of a doubt that they're planning an attack, there's very little in the way that law enforcement can do for intervention. At best, maybe, you know, take away weapons or hold them in jail for a little while. That'll buy you time, but it doesn't fix the problem. We currently have no kind of accessible mental health intervention or otherwise where somebody could say, hey, somebody I know has been posting concerning things online, has been behaving differently, is saying things that make me nervous. I wish there was, could we check in on them? Can we intervene? Is there any way we can stop this before it happens? Almost all of our recent shooters have been known to law enforcement ahead of time. It isn't like we aren't catching them. We're just not stopping them.
Mm. You know, we've got a lot of comments coming in here. One listener says, decades of psychological warfare on males, the lack of upward mobility, destruction of the middle class, social media anger, and social isolation. I'm surprised there aren't more, referring to mass shooters. And another listener says, these shooters are the canaries in the coal mine, warning us of the deep pain of society's tragic abandonment of young men. Left powerless, they're in great pain, suicidal. Most die alone. You know, for as long as there's a lack of a deep ability to moderate this kind of content, and of course that just the question of how you moderate opens up a giant can of worms, and I want to acknowledge that. And it sounds like, you know, Emmy, from what you said, there's a long ways to go with law enforcement and lawmakers. It makes me wonder about, you know, all the parents listening right now. I'm sure folks want to know, well, what can they do? What should they be looking out for? How can they be sort of that first line of intervention to stop their kids from engaging deeply with this content? I mean, Alex, what would you say?
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the main things to keep an eye out for is changes in behavior. It seems simple, but if your child is suddenly exhibiting social tendencies or otherwise that seem fairly, you know, incongruous with past behavior, if they suddenly start, you know, staying in their room and spending way more time on the computer, and if they start losing touch with in-person friends, that's something to obviously, you know, be not necessarily immediately concerned about, but something to talk about and engage with. You know, there's a lot of really amazing advantages to the internet, and I think, you know, Emmy and I probably both share the fact that we spent a lot of time on the internet in our teenage years and had some really incredible experiences on it, developing friendships and relationships that were healthy. But it is also something, if you see this in your child, if you see them spending more and more time on the internet, if you see them spending time and consuming content that you don't understand, it is something to engage that with them on, to start talking with them about.
If I could add anything, I would just say, talk to your kids, stay engaged in the stuff that they're interested in, stay engaged in the stuff that they like. Yeah, it's really important that you talk to your kids about racism and hate and violence, and let them know that when they see it, they should, you know, talk to someone about it. But mostly, just stay engaged with the stuff that your kids are interested in, even if it's video games, even if it's memes, even if it's stuff you don't get. Your kids appreciate it, and it's how you catch things before they get bad.
Well, Emmy Connolly, researcher in far-right extremism and digital propaganda, thank you so very, very much for joining us today. And Alex Newhouse at the Center on Terrorism, Extremism, and Counterterrorism at the Middlebury Institute, thank you. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken?, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes featuring Susan Fournier, Alan Questrom Professor, and Dean.
So let's start this conversation with the title of the show, Is Business Broken? It's a provocative title and a question. Where did this come from? Why that question now?
We're in a big cultural moment where capitalism, business, market systems are really being scrutinized and debated, and the role of business with it. So I think the question is just on the table. It's on people's minds. It's in the news media. It's in conversations. I think there are growing voices, loud voices, especially among young people who seem increasingly to believe that business and maybe capitalism with it are harmful and create rather than solve problems for society. And what we do seem to hear are those loud voices, and they are very black and white. There are protagonists and the antagonists and the pros and the cons, and there's really no middle discussion. It's sort of like people for and against, and it's loud.
Right. For and against DEI, for instance, right? A battle at play.
Right.
The way you describe it and the way you describe the polarization, it makes it feel like very much of the digital age, right? It feels very much of today. Some of those arguments have been around, though, right? Is this criticism of business and this question, is business broken, is that a new question?
You are so right. It is not a new question. Schumpeter, he was a professor at Harvard, and he's also maybe one of the most influential political economists of the early 20th century. He called for the death of capitalism, the death of business, 100 years ago.
Okay. Wow.
And when he critiqued way back then, he said the very successes of capitalism would bring about its downfall because it would create values hostile to capitalism, and that this would particularly take hold among intellectuals who were critiquing. So there's a lot of that same kind of dynamic happening today, and that's 100 years old. But yeah, we've seen this kind of cultural fervor playbook many times in the past, often precipitated by big crises.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken? Wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.